So yeah, I'm just testing the recording. Are you Jeff?
Yep.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Hi.
So Jeff, we are recording. So what's your language, okay?
I'll do my best. I'm sitting in a conference room in our new space, but so far it's just me. I think colleagues will join me.
Okay. So you are already 9:14.
Yep. 1 minute to go.
Yeah, that's right.
How are things in Rochester?
Oh, it's beautiful today.
Oh,
only,
good.
You know, just got down to 50 overnight, so we are good so far. No snow yet.
Morning, it's Margaret here.
Hi, Margaret.
Morning.
Hi there.
Good morning.
Hi.
This is Andras.
Andras, this is Joanne. So we
morning,
are
Andras.
Today.
Good morning.
Morning.
So it's 8:15. I know not everybody is on, but we have five papers to go, so I will start. The first one is from Memorial Sloan Kettering. And Chung et al. And Natasha Reckman is the senior author on this paper. So we all know that ciliated muconodular papillary tumor, CMPT, is relatively rare tumor. And we just come across at times. And that is characterized by peripheral location. Prominent papillary architecture is a namesake. And there are three types of cellular components, including mucinous and ciliated cells that are facing the lumen, and the basal cells are lining the bases. And the TTF1 is supposed to be positive in the mucinous and the ciliated cells, while negative in the basal cells. And those cells are positive for P63 and P40. That's what we know. And CMPT also has been shown to have certain mutations, including BRAF, EGFR exon 19 deletions, AKT, KRAS, ALK rearrangement, etc. But we have, at least I have seen, more cases. I wouldn't say it's really common, but not vanishingly rare in occasions with some nodular proliferation and, again, blend bilayered bronchiolar type cells, but does not have everything that is shown in the CMPT in the literature. So we were kind of scratching head, and I said, what those can be? And I guess this paper tries to address those cases. So concept of adenoma derived from the bronchiolar epithelium, that is not well recognized, as opposed to those the counterpart in the alveolar cells, like alveolar adenoma and papillary adenoma, at least those made WHO book. So what they did was they collected 25 cases, and 21 from their institution collected prospectively over 2-year period, and through retrospective search of their archive. And the 4 cases are from 4 different institutions, including Arizona. I realized Brandon was the donor of that case. So the 25 cases, and they described clinical and radiologic features and histologic features of the resected specimens, and did P40, TTF1, CK56, Nepsin A, BRAF, ALK, and CC10, that is for Clara cells. Those immunos were done, and molecular analysis was also performed in 19 of 25 cases by kind of more extensive panel, including 98 gene or 410 or 50 gene panel, and then one had a six gene panel. So they did a molecular analysis as well. And 25 bronchiolar adenomas were from 21 patients. In other words, some patients had multiple BAs. And 20 wedge resections, 5 lobectomies. And 10 patients underwent the procedure only for BAs, while 11 had other lung lesions, including primary lung adenocarcinoma in 12, metastatic renal cell carcinoma in 2 patients, and necrotizing granuloma in 1 patient. And 6 BAs were not seen on imaging studies and only found incidentally during examination by growth or microscopic examination for, I guess, resected for other cancers. Of the 12 patients with BA and concurrent adenocarcinomas, 3 patients had multifocal AAH or AIS. So you can imagine that could have confounding the examination, especially something like in a frozen section if they did. And 3 patients had more than 1 BA. In one case, 2 had 2, and 1 patient had 3 BAs. So in their series, there are multiple the multiple tumors can occur in one patient. BAs tend to be small, ranging 0.2 to 2 centimeter in size, and in their series, there had variable TTFM positivity in the luminal cells, as opposed to in the CNPT, they were all described as a TTFM positive. And the presence of cilia was a little variable, although majority had shown that. Basal layers are positive for basal cell markers invariably, and P40 and CK56 were used. And they described 2 types of cells. One is distal type, and that comprised 68%, and the remaining were described as proximal type, 32%. So distal type resembled morphologic and immunochemical characteristics of a more distal respiratory bronchiolar epithelium, like respiratory bronchiole right before the alveolar duct, I suppose. And many of those cases contained only focal mucin and or cilia. So that has more kind of a difference from the CMPT in that they do not have a prominent mucinous or ciliated cells, and even partly resemble type 2 cells or Clara cells, and again may lack ciliated or mucinous cells. And TTF1 tends to be more diffusely positive, however, even in the basal cells at times. In proximal type, they recapitulate morphologic and IHC features of proximal bronchiolar epithelium and composed of more abundant mucinous and ciliated cells with subjacent basal cells, and may show predominantly papillary architectures. So it pretty much look all the features of CMPTs, or closely mimicking glandular papilloma that occurs in the larger airways, more way proximal larger airways. But these cases that they describe as bronchiolar adenomas are way more distal in the alveolar parenchyma. So that's the only difference. So in one hand, they are pretty similar to CMPTs and also resemble glandular papilloma, although the location is different. And the TTF1 is negative in the luminal cells in 5 cases, however, in their series. And the mutation profile were pretty comparable, so they think they are related. The CMPT and their bronchiolar adenomas are related. So basically, beware the benign peripherally located tumors that can mimic adenocarcinoma, especially on frozen section. Although if you look closely, they are really bland appearing and has regularity without invasive growth. So that's, you know, if you think of it, that shouldn't be too hard, but you may get confused. Many of these lesions have some but not all morphology features of CMPT, and such cases were proposed to be designated as bronchiolar adenomas. So again, they try to embrace more than the CMPT can do now. And the only caveat they said also, but the there is a term bronchial adenoma that is obsolete now, but has been used in the past for carcinoid or salivary type tumor. So, you know, it may be a little confusing to some people, and needs to be differentiated from frank malignant and pre-malignant lung lesions, as well as other benign conditions such as glandular papilloma in the larger central airways. So that's a quick run through of this paper. It's really, you know, the simple-minded, but I thought it was useful. Any comments or questions?
Joanne, I don't. You say it has many of the features of CMPT, but at least a third of their cases that they called proximal type, as near as I can tell, had all of the features of CMPT. I'm also confused about their size. Their smallest lesion was 0.15 millimeters, and I wondered how big something has to be for it to merit the term adenoma. So I don't know. This paper feels like it adds a lot of confusion rather than clarifying anything.
So, you know, though, you know, I guess it's probably the experience. You know, the not every month, maybe every other month or once in 3 months. I mean, I'm saying it's not really, really, really rare. But we get, you know, consults, you know, it doesn't look like an adenocarcinoma, and what is it, question. And, in fact, Anya had a very similar case last month. And, you know, it's just I every time I had to look up the CMPT paper that Jen and others published, because it just doesn't even, the name stuck to my head. But when I just apply all the criteria that they proposed, and, you know, at least a few times that I come across, they didn't meet all those criteria for CMPT, but, you know, that's the closest fit. So that's what I felt that this paper tried to embrace. Any other have any experience like me?
Yeah, we've seen those, and they're hard to label, but I think another way to look at that is the criteria, in quotes, were based on a very small anecdotal experience, and so we're now validating those criteria and finding that they're not exactly right. But I think, as is often the case, we invent criteria, we don't validate them, and then we invent new entities when they fail to meet the kind of criteria based on low-quality evidence. So I don't know. I just think we're confusing things rather than offering clarity, personally.
Oh, well, so anyway, the only thing I didn't like about was the name that was confusing. I mean, could be confusing with a bronchial adenomas. But, you know, just conceptually, there is an alveolar adenoma. So you can, you know, imagine that something similar can occur at the level of a bronchioles. And then, you know, all kinds of differentials. The way we just think of bronchialization or peribronchial metaplasia, but at least a few cases that I've seen looked a little different from bronchiolar metaplasia in that it doesn't exactly, you know, follow the alveolar architecture, you know, that should be the bronchialization is. So anyway, well, that's depending. I'll leave it up to your discretion, and time will tell. And the more, you know, obviously to make the, you know, WHO book next time, it has to more rigorous validation. I agree with that part, but it's a good start, I suppose. Yeah. So for the sake of time, I'm moving on to the next one. This is by Galatasaray et al. Did a study on biphasic mesotheliomas. And this study was conducted by International Mesothelioma Panel. And I guess some of you are the panel members. And it was supported by the European the group. And it was in collaboration with ISLC. So it's kind of a very, in a way, authoritative kind of a study. And 2015, WHO categorized malignant mesothelioma into epithelioid, biphasic, and sarcomatoid for prognostic relevance and treatment decisions. And the biphasic was defined as either component has to be 10% or more. They tried to refine this biphasic part a little bit, and along with that, they did other the studies as well. So survival of biphasic mesothelioma may correlate with sarcomatoid component, which is not really defined in the book. I think there's no survival graph for that one. And then there was unclear criteria for sarcomatoid component and interobservable variability between pathologists for identifying this component. So that was always an issue. And they brought up transitional subtype, TMM, which refers to sheets of plum cells starting to lose epithelioid morphology, but still retain some of that, but still not overtly spindle-shaped and lacking frank sarcomatous features. And this is the morphology that, you know, people may call differently. So that has not been identified, recognized as a subtype in the WHO, but they try to bring that up again as a relevant category. So their aims were to evaluate the interobservable agreement in the diagnosis of BMM and to determine the nature of, and the significance of transitional histologic subtype, and to relate the amount and percentage of sarcomatoid component with survival, and the, finally, to evaluate the value of BAP1 immunohistochemical stain or P16 FISH in assessing the relatively bland-appearing stromal component. I suppose a really crazy-looking one, you don't need to do that, but low-grade-looking stromal component, that can be the source of interobservable variability. So the role of these two studies in differential diagnosis of true sarcomatous versus a reactive mesothelial cells, and they addressed those aims. And the cases were selected from their vast series. So among those, 971 cases in their series were biphasic meso. So they randomly selected those 42 cases based on the availabilities, and all have to be surgical excisions and all those non-morphology related selection criteria. So they send out those 42 cases to 14 international pathologists, all the member of MESO, whatever that panel members, and they reviewed digitally scanned slides, and the H&E and the pen keratin stains were scanned and distributed. And they did not know what was the diagnosis. So, you know, I was wondering, it was a study for biphasic, so they did know the, you know, it were all from the biphasic selection, but they didn't know that. So they were asked the type, either epithelioid, biphasic, or sarcoma, but they were asked to do that. And then if they could make the diagnosis based on morphology alone, cytokeratin alone, or they did both. That's another question they were asked. And the spindle component, they were asked whether they were benign or malignant. And they were not asked to determine the percent of spindle cell element. And they used for that analysis, later analysis for the percent sarcomatoid element based on prior estimation by French panel members. So they didn't decide those percent. I guess it was because of they were probably too wide. So the anticipated inter-server agreement would be low. So they didn't ask the panel members to determine that. And the grade of the tumor was asked. And I wasn't quite sure how to grade the mesothelioma, but they asked some criteria, low versus high. And then they were asked if there were any transitional type component was present. There was a fifth question, and any comments were made by these observers. I didn't put that in the summary, but they were the questions asked to the reviewing pathologist. And the analysis for transitional type, they included in the final survival analysis if at least 7 of the 14 of the reviewers said it was a transitional type. And the BEP1 loss by HC and P16 homozygous deletion by FISH were evaluated, and the Kappa statistics and the multivariate analysis were performed. So in their results, the 76 years of age was the mean, and the 90% was men, and 71% had asbestos exposure. And the 14 experts provided 544 recorded diagnoses. And if you multiply 14 by 42 specimens, there has to be 588, but only 544, so there must be some cases that were not recorded for some reasons. And the inter-observer correlation was moderate. Weighted kappa was 0.45, with agreement of a type in 71 of cases as biphasic meso, and 17% was called epithelioid meso, and the remaining 12% were called sarcomatoid type. Prognosis according to the histopathologic grouping was different from epithelioid or sarcomatoid type. And if they go by the sarcomatoid element, 80% or lower, again, by the prior French members' estimation, they are even more different from the other types from the survival. So if you look at the number, you know, I didn't copy the graphs. I apologize because, you know, copywriting, so I didn't do it this time. So anyway, if you look at the numbers, if you use the percent factor in, they are even better survival than sarcomatoid or worse than the epithelioid type. So their difference seems to be more pronounced than without using just using the all comers. So that's another thing they addressed.
Joanne, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So on their survival graph, their numbers seem odd to me because they started with 42 biphasic tumors as the substrate for this study, and they've got that number 42 in their graph, but shouldn't it be like 70% of 42? It isn't clear the survival graph captures any data from this actual study.
So, I probably didn't kind of really look at the nitty-gritty part. But what they basically, I suppose, did was they were using the cases that were agreed as the biphasic meso by the groups, the new the reviewers.
There were definitely some methodologic issues with this that became apparent, you know, when we were writing the paper. And you know, I think it was Francoise, I think, just thought it was too late to go back, and, you know, it got published. But you're right. I think some of these data come from the French group alone, not the entire group that we all looked at. So
It's just that the survival graph in Figure 3 is one that could have been generated without doing the study at all. So it just seems odd.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess, you know, if we do they probably should have done, they did the inter-observer variability. You know, I guess that's fair, you know, for what they call the biphasic meso, you know, some of them were not called as a biphase, 17% as epithelioid, 12% as the sarcomatoid. So I guess maybe they could be that. But anyway, they brought, I guess, you know, the agenda, you know, from this paper at least, you know, whether it's based on the study or their prior results, they tried to push the percent of the sarcomatoid element matters, right, Henry?
Yeah, that was one of the things. And then also this transitional
type.
Yeah, some people have called sarcomatoid and others have called epithelial.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to push those into sarcomatous, and Tom used to call them epithelial because, you know, we'd share the cases back and forth. So.
Yeah. So I guess I can totally see that is not very reproducible. So that's that. And in their result, TMM is very close to sarcomatoid group. So I guess that may be a little clue that in the future it may be better off to be included as a sarcomatoid type if we can agree, you know, I mean, we can just resolve the inter-observer variability on that. And the last result was when you have the relatively bland appearing spindle cells and you are struggling sarcomatoid versus epithelioid, I mean, like just reactive, the mesothelial cells or other types, the P6 in fish is more helpful than the BAP1. BAP1 pretty much doesn't help. BAP1 only stains the epithelioid. I mean, that shows that BAP1 loads on the epithelioid element, but those spindle cell element, it didn't really help much, whereas the P6 in fish helped 62.5% of those cases. So that's one of the take-home message for this study. So it may be useful in their conclusion. They said it may be useful to define biphasic meso with a percent. So that's again they try to put that, and the P6 and fish can be helpful to resolve the reactive versus sarcomatoid component in the low-grade looking areas. And transitional pattern has a poor prognosis akin to sarcomatoid type. So those are the three, whether they really supported by own results or not, and that's what they try to push from. Any comments? More comments? silence.
Stunned silence.
Well, I hear the sound of silence. Okay. So, I mean, this is something we need to kind of, you know, be aware of. So one way or another will just, you know, coming to us one day. And then we cannot ignore PD-L1 issue. I just put two papers side by side. One was at AGSP. It was from the University of Virginia. And it was more real world situation. And we all talk about PD-L1 heterogeneity and, you know, how to evaluate what is what. But we, you know, I'm surprised that they don't specify the method, you know, the, or I guess there is some criteria for the minimum criteria, how many cells and all that, but there have not been really studies, a lot of, at least not a lot of studies addressing the biopsy versus resection specimen. So two papers that I'm going to review are about those issues. And the first one, again, is more real world. So among the their series, like the 2011 to 2014, they had 608 non-small cell carcinoma cases, resected cases, and 51 had core biopsy with a sufficient tissue for immunohistochemistry for PD-L1. So they did a PD-L1 study, but from the get-go, they used the SP142 antibody, which we all know that the most lame antibody. There were two well-documented studies that SP142 is just outlier that looks so different from other antibodies like DACO antibodies or SP263, the Vantan antibody. So pretty much we don't use it unless it is for atezolizumab, you know, that was approved with this antibody for things. So anyway, they used this antibody and they claim they validated with a 22C3 antibody. So we have to just take their word. And then they go with less than 1%, 1 to 49%, 50% or higher, that was their category, and then called the 50% or higher as their positive criteria. And they recorded the linear size and interval between biopsy and resection, and if any treatment was done between the core biopsy and the resection, those things were recorded. And the kappa was done for statistic analysis. And I apologize, the table doesn't look pretty, and I should have put the line for your better viewing. But so anyway, this is from the table 1 and table 3. So the interval between the biopsy and the resection was 4 to 133 days. Mean was a little over a month. And the three received chemo radiation between the biopsy and the resection. So it's pretty much naive tumor without too much treatment. And the size of the core biopsy ranged from 0.2 to 2.6 centimeter, and resected tumor size ranged from 0.9 to 9.6 centimeter. And they included 25 adenocarcinoma, 21 squamous, 5 adenosquamous carcinomas. And the first one is table 1, from the table 1. And if you look at the both resection and the biopsy, red is positive, in other words, 50% or higher, true positive were in 6 cases. So there was a true positive. And then if you go diagonally, and both called less than 50%, there's a true negative was a 41 cases. And so the other things are either false positive or false negative. And the next table was a little more looking at not only the 50% or the higher category, but also for the other thing, less than 1%, 1 to 49%. So if you look at all those other things, if you go diagonally, true positive, if you go with the 50% or higher, again, 6% as in the prior table, if you go with 1 to 49%, it was 14% was concordant. And if you go by 1% was cut off, and 20 cases were concordant. So basically, they said it was pretty good. The 92.2% was concordant. And the sensitivity and specificity was, the concordant in 92% if they use a 50% as a cutoff. If they use 1%, 76.7%. You know, can imagine if you look at the whole tumor, you can find easier 1% positivity. So I think that makes sense, I guess. And the sensitivity and specificity in core biopsy was 75% and 95.3% if you use 50% criteria, and 76.7 and 95% 2% if you use 1% as cutoff for sensitivity and specificity. Again, they concluded it's largely concordant, and core biopsy may be adequate. However, it may be useful if it was negative on the core biopsy. It may not hurt to repeat on the resection specimen if it was negative, the judging from the sensitivity, their sensitivity. So that's their conclusion. Any comment?
Are people doing that as a matter of practice? If you have a resection specimen from someone who's had molecular and or PD-L1 testing on a core, do you repeat the testing if it's a negative result?
You know, we never test preemptively, so it all depends on if they ask for it. So
okay.
It all depends on clinicians, at least at Mayo Clinic. I don't know how others do. We don't do that.
Okay. Same here. I mean, they have to order it. They have to want it.
That's right. I guess, you know, that makes sense if I were the clinician, but I guess, again, it's up to them. And that's kind of, you know, it's pretty much expected in a way. But, on the other hand, I was a little surprised that their, concordance is pretty good. So that's, I guess, a little reassuring. And the next...
Joanne, could I ask?
It's sure.
Sorry, I missed the middle of your talk because I went out of cell range. But did they look at the size of the biopsy as to whether it was positive or negative, false positive?
Yeah, I guess that's a very good point. But they didn't correlate with that, no. They didn't analyze by the size of the core or a number of cells or something like that, no.
Gilbert Bigrat in University of Alberta did a study, and he did a he does a lot of PD-L1 staining, but he did like a simulated study from a core biopsy, and he showed that if a core biopsy or the bronchial biopsy, the tumor is less than 2 millimeters squared in area, the tumor itself, there was a very, very high incidence of false negatives.
Yeah, I mean,
that's correlated with the size of the area.
That's kind of a, you know, very almost predictable, you know, but...
That's up in the next study by number, of course.
Yeah, so the other case actually was a little more detailed on that aspect. So, again, this study was just, well, you know, we did the biopsy, correlated biopsy, and the resection, but they really didn't get into the, you know, those details. So it's pretty, you know, in a way kind of crude, you know. Whereas the next study from Italy, they were really get into the details in that regard. So what they did wasn't from the real world situation, but they did the core from the block, of the resected specimens. So from 268 cases in one institution over 15-year period, they made a TMA with using the 5 cores, 1 millimeter diameter 5 cores in diverse areas. You know, it's already not a real world situation. I don't know how wide the radiologists go when they do the needle biopsy. I doubt they really go like whole area. They usually go a little bit from the same area. So this is not exactly the real world situation, but I guess this will address, you know, the tumor can be from anywhere. So biopsy can be start from anywhere. So they at least maybe they can address that issue. Anyway, they did diverse areas. It's more controlled, and 5 cores per case, and they used the SP263 antibody. And cores showing neoplastic component greater than 30% were included, but if not, they didn't use that. And they used the same categories, less than 1, 1 to 49, and 50% or higher by 2 pathologists. And if they don't agree, then third pathologist comes in and they get the consensus of it. And chi-square test was used, and the raw curves were constructed to evaluate the predictability and the core biopsy samples. You know, all the usual things, kappa and all that. And they included 183 adenocarcinomas, 64 squam, 21 others, including large cell adenosquamous and the large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. And the median size of the tumors were 2.7 centimeter, ranging from 0.8 to 21 centimeter. And among those, PD-L1 positive cases were 39 percent if used 1% cutoff, and 10% if used 50% cutoff, which I think in keeping with most studies. Inter-observer variability and heterogeneity of PD-L1 expression was not very bad, really. Only 6 cases they disagree, and after consensus, 1 case was ruled as 1, less than 1 negative, and then the other case was between 1 to 49%, and the other 4 as ruled as greater than 50%. So they were able to resolve those 6 discordant cases as such categories. And because they lost in processing and all that, so they end up 250 cases with 5 cores, and 31 had 4 cores, and 16 had 3, and 4 had 2 cores, and 2 had only 1 core available. So in other words, not all cases had 5 cores, so variable number of cores, but the vast majority had 5 cores for evaluation. And in cores, a lack of concordance between 2 pathologists were higher. Kappa was still very good, but still lower than the resection cases. When all cores available for each case were considered, the concordance rates with 104 cases, they showed heterogeneity on whole sections were 93% at cutoff of 1% and 80% at a cutoff of 50%. And discrepancies were due to the heterogeneous expression. So you have to look at the paper, the figure 1, that kind of very nicely illustrated, you know, how can that happen. So that explains that numbers. And what they did, I thought was very useful in that they look at the maximum percent when they look at the PD-L1 positivity, maximum, minimum, mean, and median categories. And what is the highest rate of concordance can be achieved, the which type of the result were used. And in their result, maximum and the mean values did pretty good in the whole sections. And the lowest false negative and by the maximum value for both 1% and 50%. And also maximum value across cores was associated with high concordance between cores and then whole sections. So in other words, it's best if you look at where the you know, like hotspots did the best job. And they just gave the lowest false negative and the best, the lowest false negative and the highest, the best results. So this one has the maximum value across cores, show the highest, the concordance between cores and with the whole section, and the lowest number of a false negative overall. So their conclusion, again and again, show the maximum value did the best job. And to reach the high concordance between with the whole sections, at least four cores were needed for 1% cutoff, and three cores were necessary for 50% cutoff for positivity. So I think this study just gave good results for some guidance. I don't know if it's directly usable or not, but you know, we oftentimes have a multiple cores in the, you know, the section, and it may show variable results. And you know, I usually just the average up. That's what I have been doing. But I guess the giving the maximum number may not be a bad idea. So what do you do, actually? Do you give a maximum number or median number, or lowest? I mean, no one says how to do it, I guess. Even in Mayo, I don't know what all other people do in our group, you know. Any comment?
I share your concern, especially with a 1% cutoff. Our oncologists get pretty nervous when they think that something's below 1% and they think it should be above 1%. And I just doubt that's a very reproducible cutoff, although these studies are encouraging. But since there are no standards about how to count it, I don't know how a 1% cutoff can really perform in a way that's clinically useful.
But I have to admit, there are sometimes really dead negative cases, like nothing.
Yeah. Yep.
So those are zero. I mean, there's no problem, zero. I mean, many times that goes really quickly. But, you know, of course, there are, like, is there something or not, you know. And that's one hand. And one other hand, you know, is that one core has, like, 100% positivity, you know. And the other cores are dead negative, you know.
Yeah.
Makes still 50% or higher, but sometimes that's like, you know, maybe it make or break for 50% or higher at times. So I was wondering what may be the wisdom, you know. But I was very, you know, I have to admit that I'm not always reproducible in that regard myself, you know. For the sake of time, you can read a paper. It's kind of useful paper to read carefully. So I'll leave it up to them and to you guys. And the last paper is just almost like a case series. The think of smoking-related cystic disease that they claimed from their five cases that were found in the biopsy that was done for in the assumption of a lamb. When there were no lamb, you know, one possibility may be smoking-related cysts, and they described the findings in very simple, actually very simple paper. It was in Chest, And, you know, we come across those mysterious cystic disease. You know, the radiology shows that there are cysts and we don't see lamb or other things. And what are they? And one other things we can probably consider maybe smoking-related thing. And in fact, you know, when I saw the microscopic details, it wasn't entirely clear, you know, what exactly it should show. But anyway, there was one paper. So you can read. And the two in theme with the PD-L1, one was a review and one was, I guess, a case report. One was a good pasture syndrome. The patient died of good pasture syndrome after PD-L1 therapy in Japan. And the other case were a review paper about sarcoid dosis-like findings after PD-L1 treatment. So there may be something we may be aware of, we need to be aware of.
Thank you, Joanne.
Thank you. I'm
Thank
over
you.
Time. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.